So this is going to be a very informal talk because I've been writing it in the last 2 days on my laptop as everyone speaks because I had this idea that the way this conference is, it's so complex and it goes in so many different directions that maybe the most helpful thing to do would be to take on board the very wonderful German tradition of having someone who has to summarize everything at the end. So I've been taking notes, and I don't have notes on the last two or three talks because I was busy at that point, but on almost all the rest of them. And that's unfortunate because the last two I would love to talk about, you know, indexicality and film, so I had to pick and choose. So here's what I have in mind. First of all, I thought it would be fun to start the talk with an appetizer. I will explain this when I get to the appetizer, but I have 7 screens of opinions of people who are not in this conference on the subject of this conference, which I can report on. Okay, then the first of the subjects that I want to talk about is the convergence, if it is happening, of Bildwissenschaft and cultural studies or visual studies. And then the confluence, if it is such a thing, between Summers and Belting. And the reason I think this is of interest is because it's symptomatic of a series of, I think, confluences that are impending. And then third, is it viable to situate a general theory of images in historical work? This was the subject, part of the subject of the roundtable yesterday, but a really, really important question in any conference, but especially this one, where we are worried about general theories and how much time we should spend on them and how we should think about them and whether or not we should trust them. And then, of course, the question of materiality, which is on everyone's mind. It seems to be like a legal requirement for all conferences that they have to talk about materiality. So I will also talk about materiality. And then I chose for the last topic the question of non-European terms. Even though it only came up in one talk, in Christopher's talk, still, I think it's a very important question, especially if you're thinking about something general like picturing, which is a cross-cultural question. And then I have an intermittent theme, which is going to come back and forth, and then I'll return to it at the end, the question of writing, how we write as scholars, how we pay attention to our writing, and when that matters, and why we think it doesn't matter. and then I have one screen for conclusions, so this is what I have in mind. So first, the appetizer. I'm going to do a little reporting on this book. Brand new book, 1 week old. Edited by 3 people, and the person who gave it to me is Aud Sissel Hoel, as some of you may know. She's a Norwegian art historian. Sissel is interested in brain imaging mostly, but she does a lot of art and science things, and she's a very active scholar. And she put together this book, Images, 5 Questions, which surveys about 30 or 40 people and asks them 5 questions, and one of the questions is, what are the most important open problems in this field of images? So I thought it might be fun to rehearse some of their answers. They're all very brief in here. And this, by the way, in case any of you might be interested, it seems to be a book series. There is a number of these, and they have predictable titles, Images, Thread Questions, Ideology, 5 Questions, that kind of thing. And one title, which is just tremendously strange, and that is History of Chinese Logic, 5 Questions. Like, who was that for? I don't know. Okay. So first of all, Horst Breidekamp is in it, and so I have excerpts from all of them. They're not the full answers, but the answers are pretty short in this book. He says, the greatest problem in image studies is the lack of skill and material-based knowledge. The most dramatic effect can be observed in the sciences that, to a certain degree, have become picture disciplines without, however, knowing how to treat, store, collect, archive, and analyze pictures. So this is, of course, a theme of one of his interests. And I thought I would also, I also chose to excerpt this because in the passage just before this, he gets a little bit annoyed, if not angry, at certain art historians, he doesn't name them, who put text on pictures and don't show entire pictures and show details, which I'm going to be doing. So I thought I would put that in. He says, pictures are often treated as if when we're analyzing a poem after having cut off the last words of each line. But so I'm going to be guilty of this throughout the entire talk. Matthias Brun is also in it, and he has an interesting concluding thought, which reminds me of a kind of linguistic point. The bigger the number of pictures, the more apparent it becomes that they do not correspond to the entries of a dictionary, but to the words spoken, which is why the iconographic order of a picture book is not a hidden grammar, there is none, but only one way among others to rank and sort the material, just as a dictionary explains a word by giving a couple of new ones. It's almost like a Chomskyan ending to his contribution to this book. Gernot Bruma has an interesting last line. This is the entirety of his response. What is most neglected is the role of images in the formation of the body, concerning both the physiological status and the actual feeling of a person. Image pragmatics is a new field. Studies here are still rare, although the impression of life as living in and with pictures is overwhelming. And that's going to appear in an edited volume on theater and theater design. So I don't think that's out yet, at least according to this book, which is a week old. It's not out. Martin Jay is interested in loss of knowledge. The way Martin Jay works, this is probably his next book, so this is my guess. How has the loss or impairment of the senses been understood, lamented, and alleviated historically? Have there been radical impairments, perhaps better put as de-skillings, of the senses in different cultures, as Adorno provocatively argued was the case with the regression of listening in modern music? So I can imagine him starting to interview people about this and making a big book out of it. Mika Ball talks about collaboration and interdisciplinarity, as she has for a long time, but she has a special interest in film, as she has for the last number of years, and she calls these concepts pedagogy of visual literacy, and she calls for interdisciplinary studies in media studies departments, as you see at the bottom there. And Tom Mitchell very, very predictably says, I think the questions of vitalism and animism have emerged in recent years as topics of keen interest, and they have predictably aroused anxiety and resistance since, as everyone knows, images are not really alive. And then he finds it necessary to say, they only seem to be alive under certain conditions, because I happened to be at the inaugural lecture in 1996 when he first gave the talk, What Do Pictures Want, to his colleagues at University of Chicago, and no one could suspend disbelief for the hour that it took for him to give this talk. So ever since then, he's been saying, pictures are not really alive. And last, Barbara Stafford says, I believe the single most important issue to be addressed by the field today is the vanishing of mindful attentiveness, discernment, the awareness that we are aware, endogenous control. And she names some things, characteristics of contemporary image culture, and she says they have rendered the problem of conscious versus unconscious attention crucial. And as you know, those of you who know her work know that she's gotten more and more interested in unconscious, inadvertent, autopoetic, as she calls them, parts of culture. Okay, so on that was the appetizer. So now, on to the topics. Wanted to say something about convergences or differences between Bildwissenschaften and visual studies. And I'm taking as my jumping off point part of the conversation after Maxim's talk. And Ralph said after Maxim's talk he had a doubt about whether we should stay on the level of metaphors or whether we need a study of the participants of the black bloc, which is the subject of Maxim's talk. A study of the participants and their self-understanding. I would just like to use this as an excuse say something about Tom Mitchell, because a fair amount of the strategies of this kind of approach that was exemplified for me by Maxim's talk come from Tom Mitchell's work. I think that this question of Ralph suggests for me a way of thinking of limitations or domain of Tom's approach. Because as he himself has said in different ways, it's the study of the life of images, images as theory, as concrete pictures, living pictures, and so on, a kind of study in which the materiality of the objects may not be of primary interest. And I put in parentheses perhaps even their visual nature, because in some of the things he writes, and if he were here, he wouldn't dispute this, but in some of the things he writes, it's the political valence of the object, much less than even its nature as an image, which matters, so that there's a very interesting permeable boundary between the discussion of metaphor and the discussion metaphorical life of images and the metaphorical life of, say, a thing that is not an image, but it's about politics. It's like the difference between the politics of an image and the image of politics, kind of difference. So I have a little argument in three or four screens, a visual argument, an argument in pictures for the necessity of concrete contextual analyses. And my visual argument has to do with this, which was his opening example in What Do Pictures Want, way back from 1995, I guess, and it started. So I did an image search for this using software called TinEye, which is a really useful image search thing, company that's not owned by Google yet, and yields particular kinds of results that the Google image search doesn't yield. My interest was just in seeing what kind of varieties of this picture exist. So here are some of them. I want to fuck you, Saddam. You can see that's an old one. I want you for babysitter. Nice rack. Watching you. Supermodels.hu want you. I want you to get a real job. This was very hard to stop doing, so I have two more screens of it. I want you for Monday seminars. This was a Lille or somewhere in France does this one, even though it's in English. I want you to start treating the mayor like an adult, with a picture of the mayor, I guess. I want you to look for a girl whose name doesn't end with JPEG. Nice one, yeah. I want you to pull my finger. You are so fucked. I want you to tell me what you're drinking. I want you to piss away money on gadgets. I want you to donate to Dwarf Fortress, I guess the video game, Dwarf Fortress, yes. I want you to be my Valentine, and this one, my favorite, I want you to have a healthy poo, right? So, like I say, this is an argument in images, which I've shown to Tom, and then my only point here is just that in order to make sense of this, and therefore in order to make sense of the general claim, you have to do what I think Ralph, this is the way I take the tenor of Ralph's comment to Maxime's talk. I'm tearing it out of the context, but this is the way I take it. And I have two to end up to show the dangers of generalization. I want you, inevitably, and I suppose you could probably guess the last one. Somewhere on the internet there's this, just plain you. This would also be great for a seminar in Lacan, and there's all sorts of possibilities here, but that's all I wanted to do with it here as a suggestion. So I have three points I would like to make about this Bildwissenschaft and visual cultural studies. This is the book that Virle mentioned. I think it's the biggest study of the relationship between these two traditions. It has about 50 scholars in it. On the right is part of the table of contents of the contributors who we invited to comment, whose comments are in the book. I think Emmanuel Loa is in there somewhere, and that's interesting people, Charlotte Klonk. And there's that, and then there's another book called Theorizing Visual Studies. And this was a book which was very interesting experience for me, really disappointing, but really interesting. This is a book where I was only the editor. I didn't contribute anything to it, but I set out an international call for graduate students to fill in the entries. And the editor said this could be a textbook if we wanted it to be, and they were free to make any concepts they wanted. And we had a panel of about 10 in Chicago, and then there were two international calls, actually about 70 contributors from many different parts of the world. But it was disappointing and eye-opening to me because the... I don't think that most of this book is as radical as I imagined that it would be. I thought graduate students would be the ones to really do things that would surprise, perplex, et cetera, me. But actually, the graduate students are the ones who need jobs. So they're the ones who are most likely to be conventional. I don't know. I know, Francois, I know you've read this book. But this is my take on this book anyway. So I have a couple of screens with... three points that I want to make about. So first of all, just to reprise here something that I said in another context 2 days ago, I think it's important when you're raising this question to try to distinguish species or flavors or kinds of visual studies. And in my own way of thinking of this, there are about five flavors. There are two flavors of Anglo-American English language visual studies, cultural studies, whatever you want to call it. One of them is very politically engaged. I think it could be exemplified with Nick Mirzoff's work, who's becoming increasingly incisive and clear about his politics and his activism. And the second one is phenomenologically oriented, and it's non-political or apolitical, and for me it's exemplified by Keith Moxey at the moment. But I think these are increasingly divergent strands. There is an identifiably different Scandinavian and Latin American set of practices which often draw on semiotics more than North American visual studies or UK visual studies would. And there is also Chinese visual studies in Beijing then. But I won't go into any more detail about this because we're talking about it a couple of days ago. And I have Bildwissenschaft under erasure as the possible fifth kind of the Anglo-American visual studies by way of saying that there's a tremendous confusion about this, and I'm going to say a bit about that next. So Bildwissenschaft, paradoxically, I think, exists in a much more settled form in English language literature than it does in German language literature. That is to say, people in North America are more sure of what it is than people maybe in German-speaking countries. As an example of that, there's an essay by Horst Bredekamp that was in Critical Inquiry, and it has been taken as an indicator of a history of visual studies, Bildwissenschaft, but it's, of course, contentious, that essay, and it's a latecomer to a competitive field of creative historiography, I guess if I could put it that way. So by way of a token of this kind of contestation or confusion. Ralph said an interesting thing about this, which I'm again going to use as a springboard for something else, to say something else. You said something like, Bildwissenschaft could be thought of as a label for a response to visual studies that asks what can be done with people like Warburg and Riegel, what can we do with that inheritance. It is not, therefore, only a national or regional enterprise. One of its characteristics would be its willingness to generalize or theorize. So in the context of the conversation on the roundtable yesterday, it seemed to me like one of the proposals in the air was that to use the collective pronoun we would be people like this who would be willing to theorize, and that would have to do with an affiliation with this tradition, which is not necessarily exclusively a geographical or regional kind of a tradition, but a different sort of tradition. So and to use that, because it seems to be a very fruitful, potentially very fruitful way of thinking about this. So my third and last point about Bildwissenschaft and visual cultural studies is that I think that they differ a lot in their awareness of the history of their disciplines. This is what for me, was the main result of the Farewell to Visual Studies volume. English language visual studies is very presentist. The graduate students who contributed to the Theorizing Visual Studies book were relentlessly presentist. They didn't even care, most of them, I'm generalizing, of course, most of them didn't even care about the inception of the first visual studies programs in North America in 1988, 1990, 1989. And they didn't even care, some of them, about people as quote-unquote old as Judith Butler. They had their own theorists and their own concerns. It wasn't necessarily a change of subject matter, but it was a changing of theorization. That one essay in particular was all about José Muñoz, the queer theorist who died a couple of years ago. And that one of the points of that essay by that graduate student in this book was, we no longer need to think about any of these other earlier generation queer theorists and feminists and others. So that's what I call presentism. By contrast, people at our event, especially Gustav Frank, who Virla mentioned, were proposing some longer histories for what Gustav called visuelle Kultur, by which he meant a kind of continuous tradition, well, a tradition broken by the Second World War, but a tradition which can be now thought of as perhaps continuous, which would include people like Bela Balas and others who wrote about film. This was part of a conversation about why Anglophone visual studies tends to take photography as its principal fine art example, but film was, of course, being studied in these other contexts. So there was a lot of talk in this event and in the book about longer genealogies and basically much more awareness of the histories that led up to the discipline in question. By contrast, at the reading at the bottom there, I think that conversation implies that contemporary English language scholarship is enabled by a kind of historiographic amnesia. I'm not calling for a re-education of graduate students or anything like that, but in order to understand what's happening in Anglo-American visual studies, I think it's important to understand historical amnesia because it's part of what is going on there. So to conclude about this on this topic of the Bildwissenschaft and cultural studies, visual studies, I think in the end what may matter more than actual differences or similarities is a desire that's in the air to imagine some sort of new practice. In which case, it might be helpful to ask which practices we would like to think of as distinct from this new combination that we would like to imagine. Would it be what I like to call normal art history, that is iconography and formal analysis, old-fashioned, what we used to call pillar and post art history? I don't know if any of you heard that. When you go into a cathedral with a tape measure and then measure and then publish, right? Or would it be what I like to call North Atlantic art history, which means, in general, a kind of commonality of practice under the name of art history? Would it be the quote-unquote October School, which is always so problematic that it can barely be named? But it seemed to me that if we think of this question about Bildwissenschaft and visual studies this way, then maybe it's helpful. It would be clear things up in any given context to ask what the opposite is of the practice that we're hoping for. I think that thinking about visual studies and Bildwissenschaft is confusing or endless because I don't think it's good history. It's a kind of a game that we're playing with historiography, rewriting, as Horst Bredekamp did in his essay, for example, rewriting for the purpose of underwriting our own methodological and research interests. So I would just like to think of it as a rhetorical question, or question of creative historiography, as opposed to a question of historical inquiry. Okay. The next topic, then, is this possible confluence of Summers and Belting that was in Jakob's paper, the subject of Jakob's paper. I think very interesting microcosm of something that will be increasingly prevalent in the next maybe decade or two as people start to lump and collect theorists and others who had seemed to be quite different. I want to say first, though, a little bit about David Summers. This is Borobudur in Indonesia, a giant stupa that you walk around, and as you walk higher and higher, you get toward the Buddhas that are at the top. Is it 32? Am I right? 32 perforated stupas with a Buddha inside each one at the top. Then you're in heaven, right? So it's a circumnavigation. I'll come back to it in a second. So I would like to suggest that one of the limitations of Summers' work, which has in common as a limitation with Belting's anthropology, with Belting as anthropologist, because of course he's different things in different contexts, but in terms of his anthropology, one of the limitations would be the incapacity of their chosen ways of writing to describe details beyond certain enabling metaphors, most of which come from, in my opinion, from Merleau-Ponty, from a certain phenomenology. They include words like horizon, orientation, symmetry, space, surface, above and below, and so on. So I'm suggesting this as a common as a commonality, which is also a way of characterizing the things they can describe. And I have Borobudur there because one of the things Summers says about it in the book Real Spaces is that it asks the visitor to circumnavigate it. That's the way you're supposed to walk. And I'll in a couple minutes I'll come to a screen in which I have a couple of words about that, technical words, because there was a debate about this. Summers was criticized in a conference for not using a Sanskrit word pradakshina, which is the way that they would seem to have described, that some of the users would have described that circumnavigation, but to him the Latin word was sufficient. So I'm going to come back to this under the sixth topic. But the point I want to make here is just that that's a very general description of this extremely intricate monument. So I have another example to make, maybe this make it more detailed, another example. This is Teotihuacan outside Mexico City. It's an enormous straight avenue with pyramids all around it. And Summers writes about this at some length, and he's interested in symmetries and their relation to a certain form of government, form of empire. It's very hypothetical because very little is left of this culture. They didn't have writing, but they knew about writing, and they had signs that are like writing, and they're intriguing but largely unknown. So the Summers' analysis is, it's a formal but also a phenomenological analysis, and what he's mostly interested in is large-scale symmetries. So there it is from closer to the ground. I think his analysis works very well when it comes to the overall gestalt of the place, especially from an airplane or from the top of one of the pyramids. Works a little less well when you start looking in detail and you see that things like the enormous pyramid of the sun in the distance is not on the axis. It works a little bit less well there. But it works decreasingly well. It has more and more trouble as it gets to particularities of the site. So this is one of the small pyramids down toward the end of the Avenue of the Dead. These are all made-up names, not emic names. The feathered serpent pyramid has alternating Tlaloc corn cob god heads made of corn cobs, and Quetzalcoatl feathered serpent heads. And those are also, by the way, names that have been attached to this culture that were probably not used at all in the culture. But at any rate, This is a complex monument, which, because of the modes of gazing that confront you when you walk around it, you're looked at in the most unsettling way by eyes that are nominally looking straight ahead, but actually, of course, follow you around at all different levels. There's a particularity to that, and to the complexity of walking and negotiating these gazes, that's a little bit under the radar of the generalized interest in symmetries and things. But I have a more extreme example to end this with. There was, in 2003, a discovery made that there's a tunnel underneath that pyramid of the feathered serpent. They excavated it, and it was announced publicly in 2013, and you can still get updates on it. It's a very interesting tunnel. It's not the only one under Teotihuacan, and some of them are natural tunnels, and they're very serpentine. This one has an extremely, amazingly complex range of artifacts in it. It has sculptures, which I'm not showing here, pottery I'm not showing, shells, some of them with bas-reliefs, rubber balls, pyrite mirrors, and in this picture, clay balls covered with gold, jarosite, actually, a mineral. This is not something that many people will be able to visit because there are pools of mercury down there which have rendered the atmosphere poisonous, and they have little robots that go into there. So, but the point I want to suggest here is that at this level of detail, it's very hard to use the language of phenomenology which he chooses to use and that lexicon. So I'd like to, I'm introducing, of course, this issue of materiality here, but also as a way of thinking about things that are not enabled by those vocabularies that both Belting as anthropologist and Summers tend to choose. So back to Jakob's talk about Belting and Summers. A couple points about that. I think that I agree. I like the argument. I do think they're associated exactly the way that he claims. And I think that their association might be part of the common effect of increasing historical distance. As more time passes, we tend to naturally see similarities, and this is what all of us as historians resist. Go into your period and look at the illustrations from the 1840s, and there, I mean, you really have to care that they're different, but as we all know, there's a lot of inevitable lumping, as they say. I can imagine in not too many years another text which would put Summers and Belting together with Mitchell in this regard. The question then seems to me is, what would be the characteristics that would survive? Right? What's the core of this emerging constellation? It's not a good metaphor. It's emerging group. This emerging convergence of interests. Of course, this is only the wildest sort of guess, and so I have as a second point, the opposite could happen, and that is that we might start to see differences more than we do now. But I think that if we do tend to see differences especially between Belting and Summers, if those distances seem greater, I think it's going to be because of personal idiosyncrasies of the two of them. Jakob was saying to me after the talk that he thinks of Belting as having as his central object the body in a psychological way. I don't know if you quite said that, but in an affective way as well as in a theoretical way. And to that, I would like to add that Summers' book, The Real Spaces book, you'd think he would have room for everything in it because it's 1,200 pages long, but he's actually cut from it some things he had in earlier essays, which you can look up. One was in the Art Journal. Which cite Pagliotti and Freud, the Fort Da game, and they're all about, those earlier essays are all about the pathos of living and the way that objects and people go away from us and we need to retrieve them and the way that art becomes the substitute for that. There is a very personal, affective, driving theme in David Summers' work which has to do with pathos. I have no doubt he would not like to hear me say that, but then again, it's published, so it's this is material which for a while he imagined as being essential to articulating his interest, but then when it came to the book, it's slightly submerged. But if differences tend to reappear, then I think this is one of the ways that they might reappear. They're very different authors when they're looked at in this way. The idea of the body as the central image, as opposed to the idea of the pathos of loss. time and loss. Okay, on to the next fourth of these six, and that is this round tables question. I'm quoting here from the abstract. I think it's the last sentence of the abstract of the round table. The question is whether it's desirable and or viable to situate pragmatic uses of concepts in the context of a general theory of images. So to start out, one of the assumptions, of course, in a question like that is that there are theories of images and we know what they are. So I thought I would spend a few screens looking at that question, and I'm taking the next three slides from the introduction to the event What is an Image that took place some years ago in Chicago. These next three screens were intended to open the conference by raising the question, why should we bother to ask what is an image? So we have kind of like two questions here. First of all, if we're going to attach our work to general theories, what are they? And second, why would we want to do this? Because in any number of settings, it would not be looked on well. I won't tell any stories about that, but there are plenty of historians resisting any sort of general theory. So these three screens, which represent are meant to evoke three different activities or practices. First of all, in the studio art environment regarding artists, and I'll talk about this picture in a second. In terms of studio art, it's still very often assumed by working artists, student artists, young artists, our brains are divided into right and left brain, and I've had many art students over the years tell me they can't write because half their brain is missing, but they have really great visual capacity. I mean, there's a lot riding on this claim for some people that half their brain is visual. In which case, you would think that it would be very important to know what the visual is. And the corollary of that, or the consequence of that, is the idea that some things can be communicated through the visual and not through other senses or media. It's one of the exclusivist claims about the visual that recur. It's also widely assumed in art academies and art departments and art schools that the visual is politically privileged, which on the face of it is a paradox if you believe in a version of the first two entries there, but this is what's said. And one of the corollaries or consequences of that is that politically oriented practices are sometimes said to be optimally situated as visual arts practice, so that visual art is the optimal medium for expression of political thought. So these are contradictory positions, but very fiercely held, and they would be answers to the question, why ask what is an image to begin with? Regarding this picture, this is a student of mine copying one of our Mondrian paintings, I was thinking of Robin's paper, especially in this, because the original of this and other paintings from the 20s, Mondrian's, are very painterly. This is the copy, but my next screen, you'll see in a second, is the original of the same part of the painting, and you'll see that he often didn't use his famous masking paper strips, but he preferred to paint freehand in a different way, so it seems to me, than Albers was. So there's the original. You get this kind of like a step effect of going this way. And anyway, they're very painterly in that way. So second of these three would be from the position of art criticism or art theory, art history. Why ask this question? Because many historians and critics work with received ideas about what images are. So why ask what is an image? The answer would be because you don't want to base your life's work on other people's theories, maybe, if you want to be the theorist. Relatively few people have accounts of images. Belting, Gottfried Böhm does, Tom Mitchell, and now Ubel and Pickler. This is the most recent book that I know of, I'm probably missing one, but that does attempt to theorize images in an interesting and systematic way. There is also, along with this issue of the relative paucity of theories of images for art history, there is also the fact that there's no discourse within art history to adjudicate, to watch over the presence of a partly or wholly non-historical theory. Several of these theories have non or ahistorical moments because they are theories of the image, but there's nothing in the logic of art history to help decide how to put that together, how to put together an historicized account with an account that speaks from outside of a certain history. And last of these three is having to do with visual studies and Bildwissenschaft. Especially Anglo-American visual studies puts huge weight on the claim that we are the most visual culture ever since the dawn of time. We have all the best visual skills. Visual objects are said to be characteristic of our period. And I put in here a little parenthetically, this is the kind of generalization, the iconophilia generalization against which Michaels was talking. It's even said, there's a radical version of this, it's even been said that we think and experience primarily through images. And both Nick Mirzoff and Lisa Cartwright have both said this in different publications. That's a really strange, interesting claim. What in the world does that mean to say that our imagination is images and then somehow becomes text? Anyway, it's a hyperbole of the vision euphoria that drives Anglo-American visual studies to some degree. And yet, very few visual studies scholars think about the nature of the visual. There's very little written in the name of visual studies which tries to think about this problem. So in all three cases, images are central, but they're often taken as given. This would be the way to answer the question, why worry about this? In the event, the what is an image event, that led us to two questions, which I'm just going to give you here, but I won't pursue them. The first one was, how is it possible to open the question of the relation between pragmatic uses of the concept and a general theory when there are so few theories? In that event, we did. There was a lot of work done in a seminar leading to that event, What is an Image event, in which in the seminar we looked at lots and lots and lots of image theories through history. There are obviously lots of them, but very hard to know which ones might be pertinent or usable. And then, more interesting to me, is what is enabled by not pressing the question, what is an image? Because it's the same kind of example as it was a few minutes ago about the presentism of visual studies. Since much of what is produced under the name of art history is, or visual studies or these other fields, since much of what is produced is written by scholars who are not themselves devoting themselves to a theory of the image and attaching themselves to a theory of the image, then obviously this lack of care or this insouciance about a general theory must be enabling. It must enable the practice. It must be an important characteristic of the practice. So what is enabled by not pressing the question of what is an image? Okay, so then about the roundtable yesterday and whether or not it's desirable to situate ourselves in a general theory of images. If it's true, as I take it, that Ralph was suggesting that our scholarship is interested in general theories and in the connection between research and general theories, what I would like to know is this. Is the form of our question, the question is, how is our work related to general theories, is the form of our question similar to the form it had for our predecessors and our theory models? In other words, did Benjamin think about this kind of issue in the same way? I don't think so. There's an interesting difference. I think, for example, with Riegel and Warburg, they were both of them in different ways. They're very invested in trans-historical concepts. So it wouldn't have been an object of anxiety for either one of them to ask about the connection between a local practice and some enabling or driving concept. For Benjamin, it's different. I mean, for my reading of that would be that he historicizes throughout. Everything is historicized. Thought takes place in and as history. So again, there wouldn't have been an issue of the desirability or viability, at least not in the way that that it comes up now. So what I'm pointing to is the fact that the interest or anxiety that we have about how to connect, when to connect, should we connect, should we ignore the general theory, if not, how is it? That interest is itself doesn't include the theorists that we take of as the ones who underwrite much of our work and our interest in articulating our own practices. We live in a different historical moment. So it would be of interest to me to know more about that. It would be nice to come to a better understanding of our condition and the limitations that it places on our answers. So it's the different form of our anxiety, if I could call it that, or even just the presence of the anxiety that makes the decisive difference as far as I'm concerned. Okay. Then the question of materiality, impossible question. So just two observations about this. The first one is shorter. So first of all, it doesn't seem to me that materiality has a settled approach yet. It's a lot like affect theory in the sense that it comes from many, many, many places. It comes in many flavors: Harman, Brown, Maisu, Bryant, Morton, Latour, Deleuze, Bataille, Krauss, Albers in Robin's paper, and even maybe Huey Copeland in Lauren's paper. You can really pick and choose. You can really go as far, up and down and find many, many different mutually incompatible sources for materiality. So invocations of it as a general term, I think, are still unclear. Affect theory has a little head start, and it's settling out. Another example of this same problem for me is the revivals of beauty in the last 15 or 20 years. There have been lots and lots of revivals of beauty, and they shake out, and we prefer one or the other. In the art world, it's still the North American art critic Dave Hickey, who is practically unknown in most of the rest of the world, but he represents the revival of beauty for a certain group. So, again, I think it might be useful to ask instead about what the opposite of our attention to materiality is in any given case. What is it that we picture ourselves as avoiding by looking to what we call materiality? Maybe certain connoisseurship in some cases, or formalism, or the sometimes by Rachel slightly demonized social art history, or maybe Tom Mitchell's image science. And anyway, it might be useful to navigate by looking backwards to see what it is that seems worth avoiding. The second point about this is that I'll give at a little bit greater length is I think that the attention that is paid to the support, the object, the material, the thingness, physicality, and so on is relative. I think in art history there are still very easily definable limits to what counts as attention, the closest attention that you can pay to an image. And I'm going to give an example of this from a conversation that is recorded in the transcribed in the book, What is an Image? I have a little bit of extreme close-ups of Pollock, just so that we have some materiality to look at while I'm reading this. So this was in a conversation, Jacqueline Lichtenstein said that she was not happy with the art historians at the table because, she said, they were not really talking about paintings. She said, we were only talking about pictures or images, and we needed to pay attention to materiality, and she read us some passages from Zola and Weizmann to show how you pay attention to materiality of images. So she said, in the distinction between image and painting, I would like to stress the painting's physicality. Today, in the age of the internet and the digital image, it's important to recall that the painting has physical material properties. And Marie-Josée Monzen, who was also there, said, she talked about Daniel Arras, and she said that he used details to drive the gaze of the viewer, and that the idea was to move to another level of temporality in the experience of the image. And then we talked about Friedrich Thea Bach, and we had several other examples of art historians who do look very, very closely at materiality or details. But it seems to me that it is possible to go even farther. I was kind of unhappy at this part of the dialogue because the art historians didn't have examples to tell Jacqueline that they had done better than Zola, right? Which was odd. It seems to me that it's hard to know if there is such a thing as a detail or an object and part of the materiality of the object that's so small or so difficult to name that you can't pay attention to it as history. This is, of course, the fear that if you look too closely or your material becomes just base materiality or it becomes non-historical, it's no longer an object of historical attention, brute material, I guess. But my feeling about this is that that's not necessarily the case, that what more likely to happen is that interpretation just slows down, as Marie-Josée Monzen said about Arras. I tried this in a book called What Painting Is, and this is one of the pictures from that book. I had these pictures where I just gave myself like 2 inches to look at and trying to see something that could plausibly be of interest, not from an art historical standpoint. I'm not going to defend that book here, but not from a formalist standpoint. In other words, marks with meaning of different sorts. So I'm not convinced that there's an intrinsic limit beyond which the historical becomes the formal or the conceptual becomes the material. The problem is not that there is no historical meaning in these smallest marks, that they're non-conceptualizable. I think the problem is just that it becomes very difficult to write when you're looking very closely. You can look at a patch of material in your chosen object and be happy that you noticed it and you could say something about it, but then there's always parts of that patch and other patches like it and so on. Just to say this also goes for contemporary art, I have a couple of slides of a student of mine from a couple years ago, Boris Osterov, who's now a starving artist and needs a gallery, and he's trying to be as excessive about material as he can. He made things like this where he took a plank and sticks it into a wall and then puts his paint all over it. But his gestures were just as carefully thought out, well, more carefully thought out than the bit of Pollock, of course, but his gestures are very carefully thought out. He used up huge amounts of paint making these things because you can only do it once and then you have to throw it out and start again. But something like this even could be analyzed carefully, slowly. It is a certain gesture. That's why he cared that it looked exactly like this and not like something else, right? It has its own meanings and decisions went into it. That's, by the way, a hairdryer that's pointing to it because he had real trouble getting these things to dry out enough to make the gallery, make the show that he had. And I'll just close this part with one counterexample, and that is Tim Clark's book, The Site of Death. I think that this issue of materiality is obscured in his book in many ways because, you know, he's Tim Clark. He's doing lots of other things. He's not joining debates about materiality. But in the course of this book, he looks very closely and finds historical meaning and ties it into wider meanings that he's interested in. And I have this screen from the Google Art Project, which is also in his book. Tiny detail from the back of the Poussin painting, Landscape with Calm. And Tim talks for about a page on the green stripe that represents a meadow. The green stripe is actually even longer in the painting. But in the actual painting, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny thing, right? And he manages, of course, his way of writing helps a tremendous amount because he weaves it back into his historical account. But it is not a moment of isolated formalism. It's a moment of interpretation. So this is just an example that from art history. Okay, last of the subjects is the possibility of using non-Indo-European terms to rethink picturing, which, as I said, really only came up in Christopher's talk, but I think it's important. So it's part of a very wide debate, and I would just propose for heuristic purposes that you can think of these positions as a spectrum. On the one hand would be people like David Summers, because from his point of view, terms that come from Greek and Latin are malleable and capacious and can be used to describe the art of any culture. So you don't need a non-Indo-European term. On the other end of the spectrum, the far other end, would be scholars who use indigenous terms. In between, large part of the spectrum, which includes Christopher's work, would be scholars who use selected terms but embed them in wider art historical narratives. So I give you a couple of examples of two and three to finish. So here's an example of two. This is Robert Thompson, who studied African art and is very influential because he's the person who, quote-unquote, discovered or invented Yoruba aesthetics. The claim is that the Yoruba culture had an aesthetics. In 1971, he made a survey, as you can see there, of people, asking them how they talked about their sculpture, and he ended up with 19 aesthetic terms. Just to give an example, Jijora is one of them, which he defines as the balance between realism and abstraction. All kinds of very fundamental questions remain here, which I'm listing because they show how even now, so many years after Thompson and with other claims of aesthetics from other cultures, even now really basic questions continue to be asked. Like this, are there really 19 terms? Were they accurately reported even? Are other terms more important? Because after all, realism and abstraction is a traditional concern of Western art criticism and theory, so it seems like he might have privileged it. Is aesthetics the right term? Is aesthetics a European category? This is also still under debate. To what extent can form be separated from content in Yoruba practice? Because that's also a modernist interest, so it might have been projected. And just to show you that this is ongoing, a more recent example, this is Roland Abiodun, who's written on this subject, and he prefers another term, ase, which he defines this way. This term is immediately embedded in a whole range of Western concepts, which I listed the bottom two lines, and you could see in his text. So there's this question of the inrushing of the supporting Western concepts, even when you're trying to be very, very careful about your indigenous concepts. Okay. So a couple of examples of this common position three in the middle of the spectrum. These are terms which have all been employed and debated. This first list is Chinese ones. Hua was in Christopher's talk, and I'll come back to it in a second. Guai is the word that's used to in English, it's eccentric, as an eccentric inkbrush painting. But of course, eccentric is a very Western word. Qi, that everybody knows. Qi is so exhaustively discussed that I was at a conference one time in Tokyo, and this word came up, and the Japanese scholars just sighed in despair. Like, oh no, do we have to talk about this again? Because nothing was going to come of that. And just to show some others these are very wide-ranging examples of things that have been discussed. Darshan is the subject of an influential book by Carolyn Eck. It's a mode of seeing pertaining to Hindu sculpture. Here's the reason why I showed the Borobudur piece, because that's the Sanskrit word pradakshina, which was proposed to David Summers as the proper indigenous term, the Amic term that he should have used instead of ambulatio. Ma in Japanese has a really interesting history, which would be the subject for some other conference. But it means distance in space, distance in pitch, in musical pitch, and distance in time, among many other things. And it's used in Japanese garden aesthetics, and it was adopted enthusiastically in the 80s and 90s. It was the subject of several exhibitions, at least one of them here in Paris. And now it's kind of out of favor. No one wants to use it that much anymore. I won't stop for this, but a really good text here is Heidegger's Conversation with a Japanese, in which he gets a term from his Japanese philosopher companion, which the Japanese philosopher intentionally mistranslates for him. And this has led to a literature in Japanese, some of which is also in English now, in which the Japanese philosopher describes what he did in order to stop his term from being swallowed by metaphysical machinery. Okay. And there are also Australian Aboriginal terms, but I won't stop for that either. And then in Christopher's talk, there were these. So you can add these. There's a long list of these terms that have quite substantial literature and that raise over and over again the question of how to keep a term alive in its new context. So I have just a screen to end on with conclusions about this. Maybe four possible outcomes of this kind of thing. The terms, of course, can just remain in their context of local studies. And you study, write about Japanese art, and your monograph contains the term. That's not relatively common and unproblematic. Then there's this option. The Japanese scholar Shigemi Naga criticized the book Critical Terms for Art History for not including any non-Indo-European terms, even in its second edition. This option, of course, I can easily see why the editors, Richard Schiff and Rob Nelson didn't do it, because if you have 15 chapters with terms like image, and then you add something like from Australian Aboriginal language, then it's going to be tokenism of the worst sort. So they think they can't do it. And then there's Kersey's suggestion, which in the notes that I took anyway, something like this, that you would want to use your terms to guide a new theoretical framework, maybe to make a kind of lingua franca for picturing or imaging, which could circulate in several languages. I mean, it's ideal, but it would avoid the issues of the first of those two. There's potential problems with these strategies, of course, that the embedding begins immediately after the quotation, the embedding in Western terms. In the abstract and the talk, there were all of these terms that I made notes of, which were helping to support and recontextualize the Japanese terms. So I think, for me, what matters here in trying to figure out what's going on in cases like this is the width of theory. That is to say, do you count as theory just the terms and their immediate definitions, or do you count the terms and the interpretive context they're in, or do you count the narratives of art history in which they're embedded, or do you count the institutions, including institutions of for conferences and things like that, the largest largest frames? Okay, I'm going to go straight to the last. I'm just going to do this as my last screen, and then I'll go to my screen of conclusions. So this is my own. Oops, back to that. So this is my own provisional answer to this. The book that Virla mentioned that I've been writing along with this historian, Erna Fiorentino, is in Berlin. And this is a big textbook. It's going to be a big textbook on visual things. And we did not want to publish a book, yet another book on the image, which had nothing outside of Indo-European terms. But we had no idea what to do. So our own solution is we picked three or four terms. Two of them are here. To privilege. We describe them in the beginning, and we put them through the whole text no matter what we're talking about. We apply them in many different new contexts. The first one is citta, which is a Pali word, fabulous word, that means both consciousness and picture. If any European language had that, it would be fabulous, that if your picture represented consciousness, was consciousness. Anyway, lots of potential there. And xiang is a Chinese word that's also very complicated, and it's been translated as phenomenon, appearance, likeness, imitation, resemblance, figure, symbol, metaphor, imaginary, and imagination. So it has a capaciousness and a potential. So what we do in our book is we say at great length at the beginning, we are not trying to represent these terms in their original quote-unquote meanings. We are not trying to represent the cultures that they come from, and we are not trying to produce new configurations like citta plus imago or something like that. What we're trying to do is just set up the concepts in an unfamiliar context and see what kind of work they do. And we just wanted to make sure that we did that, even if it fails, so that we don't produce yet another textbook that doesn't have non-Western terms. Okay, my last screen, which is conclusions. So about the convergence of Bildwissenschaft and visual studies, I would like to suggest that this can be thought of productively as a question of desire rather than a question of historical veracity. About the confluence of Summers and Belting, it seems to me that it might be, because it's so plausible, it seems so right to me to the way it was presented, that it might be part of an inevitable grouping, which we would want to question and see where it might go. About the question of whether or not it's viable to situate a general theory, I think maybe a good starting point there would be to try to figure out why it is that this is a problem for us in the form that it is a problem and when it started to be a problem, to historicize our question. And then about materiality, it seems to me that our texts have a long way to go before they get as close to the objects as our theories think we are. Right? Our texts aren't quite there yet. And then last about these, that current strategies for solving this problem are still very much North Atlantic in their practices. And then my last three lines are about this theme of our own voices and our own writing. I think that our writing on everything, all these issues, remains pretty much uninterrogated. I think there's a big disparity between our really vigilant articulateness about the meaning of images and what I think of as our impoverished attempts to analyze our own writing. There's almost no awareness of the whole history of rhetoric and close reading in art history departments. It's all over in the literature departments. It doesn't exist in art history. So it might be of interest to try to write even more slowly and with more attention to voice and to affect. And that's it. Thanks.